This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
Thousands of his supporters went on a looting spree, destroying shops and property, and vowing to make the country ungovernable until Zuma is released.
That's Tuso Khumalo reporting on concerns there may be protests after a South African court ordered to return Jacob Zuma back to prison. Details coming up. Also, the Committee to Protect Journalists is calling on the Ethiopian government to free detained journalists. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. Istanbul hosts a two-day African summit this week, the latest effort by Turkey to expand its diplomatic and economic influence in Africa. For VOA, Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
After a two-year delay caused by the COVID pandemic, Istanbul begins hosting the Turkey-Africa Partnership Summit on Friday. But with the Omicron variant spreading hours before the start, it remained unclear who would attend. The summit is part of an effort that has seen Turkey opening 30 new embassies while pushing an aggressive trade policy. Jalal Hajawi is a senior fellow at the Geneva-based Global Initiative, whose work concentrates on North Africa's security landscape.
A lot of consulates and embassies, which is not the trend followed by a typical Western country. Usually Western nations are closing down their diplomatic representation in Africa, regardless of how important it might be over the next couple of decades. And the Turks are also very convincing because they work fast. They offer construction projects at relatively affordable prices. They adapt to the culture.
Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan is a regular visitor to Africa, visiting the continent 28 times since 2003. But Turkey's ambitions are creating points of friction, stoking rivalries with France, a former colonial power in much of the continent. And in the Libyan conflict, it backed the side opposed to the faction supported by Egypt. A rivalry that has led to Turkish businesses complaining they've been forced out of the lucrative Egyptian market. Ali Eren is a CEO of Erensan, a Turkish company that exports industrial boilers.
In Egypt, there is quite good textile industry there, and also automotive and other types of industries where we can, you know, find ourselves very comfortable in this industrial environment there. Also technical people. So Egypt has been a loss for us.
Turkish and Egyptian diplomats have been holding talks to improve ties, and those talks may continue on the sidelines of the Istanbul summit. There will also be discussions on trade. Ankara touts the recent sale of military drones to Morocco as an important breakthrough for the Turkish defense industry. State figures show Turkey's trade with Africa has increased fivefold to $25 billion since 2003, much less than China's. For Erdogan, it pays huge political dividends at home. So says observers like Yusuf Kenan Kucuk, a former Turkish diplomat to Sudan.
The government can portray itself to its voters as being a global player or supporting the friendly government, like Muslim states, for instance, Somalia in Africa. So it is very much appreciated, in fact, in Turkish public, Turkey's engagement in Africa. So I think it is that the three things, Turkey's international visibility, a trade partner, and the domestic politics.
With the Turkish economy hit by a currency crisis, Erdogan will welcome any boost the summit can bring. But analysts warn a looming economic crisis will mean Ankara may not have the funding to sustain its efforts in Africa. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Ministers in charge of security agencies in South Africa say they are ready to deal with any violence or disturbances that might rise following a court decision ordering former President Jacob Zuma to go back to prison. The High Court yesterday ruled that the decision by the correctional services to release Zuma on medical parole was illegal. It ordered that he should be taken back to prison to serve his full 15-month sentence for contempt of court. Zuma's incarceration in July caused riots countrywide. Tuso Kumalo reports from Johannesburg.
Security ministers in charge of the police, defense and justice portfolios said Thursday that security forces were ready to make sure there is no repeat of the riots in July. Zuma was imprisoned in July after disobeying the court order to appear before a commission of inquiry investigating corruption. Thousands of his supporters went on a looting spree, destroying shops and property, and vowing to make the country ungovernable until Zuma is released. In September, the correctional services released him on a medical parole for an unspecified illness. Wednesday's High Court decision overruled that parole. At a news briefing in Pretoria, Police Minister Begicele said the law enforcement agencies have a plan in place and are ready to act.
Members of the South African police, including all the law enforcement agencies in the country, have learned their lessons last July, and the experiences gained from there will be used and utilized to make sure that South Africa remains safe, stable, and calm, and all people in South Africa protected together with their properties.
In July, it took the deployment of up to 25,000 troops to end the riots. Minister of Defense Thandi Modise said at the briefing that her forces will be ready to hit the ground running if the situation demands their presence.
If there is any issue which might create any uncertainty to life and limb, to property, to the economic interest of the country, defense gets interested. So we will not hesitate if we are approached to be on standby.
Zuma supporters are calling for opposition to his reincarceration. His foundation has described the court judgment as vindictive and unjust. And the Youth League of the ruling African National Congress in the region where Zuma comes from has also registered its opposition to the ruling. Justice Minister Ronald Lamola called for calm during the media briefing.
It is important that we allow the due processes of the law to take its course. The parties themselves are engaging on the matter in the court processes. So inflammatory statements and unwarranted attack on the judiciary will not help the process.
Zuma is still at his home after his foundation announced that his lawyers have applied for leave to appeal the judgment. The Department of Correctional Services has also indicated that it is appealing the decision. Tuso Kumalo for VOA News, Johannesburg.
Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch today issued a statement accusing Amhara security forces of killings and forced expulsions of ethnic Tigrayans in Ethiopia's northern region. The two humanitarian organizations asked the Ethiopian government to cease attacks on civilians, secure the release of those arbitrarily detained, and urgently provide unimpeded access to Western Tigray for aid agencies and organizations. Given the gravity of the ongoing abuse, the two groups are asking the UN Human Rights Council to urgently establish an independent international mechanism to investigate abuses in the Tigray conflict. Also today, the Committee to Protect Journalists is calling on Ethiopian authorities to immediately free all detained journalists and stop using wartime emergency laws to lock up reporters. The CPJ statement came after police arrested a freelance video journalist working for the Associated Press and two local reporters. Journalists working in Ethiopia face restrictions under a state of emergency the government declared last month as it continues its 13-month conflict with Tigrayan rebels. The Associated Press has called for the immediate release of Amir Aman Kiyar, Yaro, who has been accused of breaching state of emergency laws, promoting terrorism, and spreading propaganda. The AP described the charges as baseless. Authorities in the Democratic Republic of Congo on Thursday declared the end of an Ebola outbreak that emerged in early October in North Kivu province and infected 11 people, killing six of them. The DRC declared its 13th outbreak of the disease on October 8th in Beni, in the east of the country, prompting fears of a repeat of a 2018-2020 epidemic that killed nearly 2,300 people in the same region. The World Health Organization says medical workers vaccinated more than 1,800 people using Merck's recently licensed vaccine to prevent Ebola, which the WHO said helped limit infections. Even as the DRC officials are making the end of the Ebola outbreak, there are new concerns about an outbreak of monkeypox in Maniema province. The disease, which is similar to smallpox, though milder, causes fevers and lesions all over the body. It was discovered in monkeys in 1958, and there have been sporadic outbreaks in Africa since then. VOA's Kate Bond-Dawson spoke with reporter Jafar Al-Kitanti in Goma in the eastern DRC about the outbreak.
In the central DRC, in the province of Maniema, close to the equatorial forests, the governor communicated about the outbreak of monkeypox. But myself, I knew about it. There is 2 weeks ago, someone sent me photos from a small clinic with people suffering, and the guy said it's a new sickness. We don't know how we can manage to cover it. And when I saw the picture, I asked one of my friend who is a doctor. He told me about monkeypox. And I tried to contact the governor of Maniema. He didn't know about it. But 2 weeks after, he said the province has more than 200 cases and around 30 deaths.
So about 30 deaths then out of about 200 cases. Now, what is monkeypox? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Monkeypox is virus from some animals like monkey and mouses. And the monkeypox was for the first time in DRC in 1970. It was the first outbreak of monkeypox in the world in our country. So, as you know, the DRC is has many problems of many health problems, and as we have a big forest, so we can say a storage of lot of viruses.
Now, in the area, in the province where this has been found, is there a healthcare system that can reach and help these people?
In the province, yes, there is a big hospital in Kindu. But from Kindu to the region where the outbreak is around 200 kilometers. And that's the problem. Even when doctors decided to share the samples of the virus, they need 1 week waiting the result from the National Institute of Biomedical Research because it's far. And the problem, many challenges in the country, no good roads, and some areas there is no internet, so they have to wait physically for the result from the capital city of the province.
That was journalist Jafar Al-Kitanti in Goma in the eastern DRC. He was speaking with my colleague Kate Bond-Dawson. of the 37.7 million people living with HIV globally, over 20.6 million live in Eastern and Southern Africa, UNAIDS data show. The United Nations Agency's director of this worst-affected region, Anne Gituki Shongwe, spoke to reporter Vicky Stark about the recently concluded 21st International Conference for AIDS and Sexually Transmitted Infections in Africa.
Anne Gituki Shongwe says one of the big outcomes of the conference was the formation of a new global coalition to eliminate vertical transmission of HIV among children. She says this is crucial if there's any hope of ending AIDS by 2030.
A correlation between early unintended pregnancies and children born to HIV. You know, stigma and discrimination and lack of information for the young girls means that they're not able to ensure that they're taking ARV during pregnancy and during breastfeeding, and so they are transmitting to children. And so it is one of the areas that if we're looking to end AIDS, we have to be able to end this transmission to children.
Gituki Shongwe was among the moderators at the annual International Conference for AIDS and Sexually Transmitted Infections in Africa, or ICASA. The Society for AIDS in Africa hosted the conference in Durban, but had to cancel plans for delegates to attend in person after a number of them tested positive for COVID-19. Only speakers, moderators, technical support staff, and the media were allowed at the venue in Durban. She says there were 680,000 AIDS-related deaths last year. 310,000 of them were in East and Southern Africa. In recognition of how dire the situation is, Gituki Shongwe says there was a high-level meeting at ICASA that saw government representatives reaffirm support for the East and Southern African commitment for addressing the needs of adolescents and young people. She says this will allow comprehensive sexuality education in schools in the region, which in some countries can be controversial.
It's about trying to ensure that every child, every girl, every young person knows what they need to do to prevent HIV, to prevent STDs, to prevent pregnancy, you know. And because there has been a lot of misinformation and campaigns against this that are accusing proponents of comprehensive sexuality education of teaching children about sex rather than about the tools and skills and information that they need to be able to, you know, be informed and prevent HIV, it has tended to be quite controversial. So it's a very important milestone because we can now go ahead and push hard in schools to make sure that this happens. It also emphasizes the access to sexual and reproductive health services for adolescent girls and young women, including looking at the issue of legal age of consent, and for them to be able to go and get the kind of treatment and services that they need.
And what's on UNAIDS's agenda in the new year?
Prevention, 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 breaking structural barriers, you know, is crucial. The issue of inequalities is a big piece there, and the fact that when we see 4,200 girls getting infected across this region from HIV every week, it is not because of their, you know, badly behaved selves. It's much more about the fact that they are in the midst of real deep inequalities that result in them being involved in very risky transactional sexual relations that are also intergenerational, and they're often older men who are able to pay and transact.
She says there were talks at ICASA about social protection in the form of social grants for adolescent girls and young women.
There have been interesting tests, and there's examples in Zambia and Malawi, Kenya, where they've used cash transfers. I think there's even one or two projects in South Africa where they say, like, if we put X amount of money into the hands of young girls, would that reduce their vulnerability to HIV and therefore the risky decisions that they're taking? And they've been able to show a strong correlation that they will begin to make different choices in terms of these transactional sexual relationships.
Promoted as the biggest HIV/AIDS conference on the continent, ICASA ended on December 11th and drew over 3,000 participants from 67 countries. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
Zimbabwe is poised to import 400 megawatts of electricity from neighboring Mozambique and Zambia. The move will help alleviate its inability to produce enough power for the country's consumers. From Bulawayo, reporter Adi Gando has more on the story.
The Zimbabwe Electricity Supply Authority, or ZESA, says the country has been experiencing massive load shedding and is expending close to US $20 million on power imports every month. To mitigate that deficit, Zimbabwe has negotiated for 280 megawatts from Zambia and 180 megawatts from Mozambique. Mambo Hamaundu, an economic analyst from Zambia, agrees that his country is in a position to export to Zimbabwe.
You know, you must appreciate that we have recently, there was the curfew law which was commissioned. We have Mamba plant, which is also supplying quite some electricity. We also have the old Kariba. And there are a number of independent power producers who are actually supplying into the main grid. So if all these are operating at 100% capacity or very close to 100%, I believe that would actually have more electricity in the country than what is required. Because before the coming on board of the Kafue Gosh power station, the deficit stood at about 750, and with the commissioning, it was expected that it would actually wipe out the deficit. But we can export as a country, you know, to power industry within the neighboring countries. I think that Zambia does have that ability, but it needs to be enhanced.
Zimbabwe, however, has outstanding debts which must be cleared before the imports can be received. The boss of the Electricity Supply Authority, Sydney Gata, said in a recent interview with state media that licensed independent power producers have the potential to generate 6,000 megawatts. Observers say his statement raises questions since the power authority attributes the energy crisis in part to bureaucratic delays by the Treasury in signing agreements with independent producers to produce electricity. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko weighs in.
Yes, we have the very big opportunities. Throughout the year, we have the sun for solar, we have large deposits of coal. All these are potential investment areas that can be looked into to deal with the energy deficit challenges this economy and the country is facing. But the environment, is it conducive? Is it viable to go into such? And we also have had situations where there's been major delays at ZERA, which is the regulator, in terms of giving license for power generation. The bureaucracy is too much. You walk into another jurisdiction, you have a license inside 2 weeks. Zimbabwe stages that might take you 3-4 months to get. That's all frustrating investment.
Observers say that Zimbabwe needs to vigorously pursue renewable energy options together with global efforts to reduce carbon emissions. Meanwhile, Zimbabwe's neighbor and biggest trading partner, South Africa, managed to secure US $8.5 billion in funding to help wean it off non-renewable energy. Like Zimbabwe, its coal-powered energy dependency is a source of concern for climate change activists. The main difference between the two countries is that at the recent COP26 climate conference, European Union member states and the United States cobbled together a deal to help South Africa migrate to renewable energy sources. Zimbabwe is not yet attracted any investment into alternative energy sources aside from the Chinese firms which are active in supporting the country's efforts at generating thermal power. They are also engaged in coal mining activities which activists say degrade the environment and are unsustainable. The government is on record saying that the country has an even split between renewable and non-renewable energy sources. It says its solution is a staggered approach to expanding non-renewable energy. Reporting for VOA, this is Adi Gondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.